It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll revisit our We Are the Valley community series and find out more about sexual assault on college campuses. Plus, there's a new documentary about former Phoenix Suns star guard Steve Nash. We'll hear from the film's director. We start today's program with a look at options for Arizona's deep budget deficit. State Senate President Andy Biggs will be in an influential position to decide in what direction Arizona goes, and he joins me now. How bad is the state budget situation considering the deep cuts that were made just a few years ago to deal with another huge deficit?
Yeah, I would say it's very significant. I would not say it's something to panic about, but I think it's something to plan and use as to make true permanent structural corrections that we probably need to make.
What is going to lead to the momentum to make those structural changes? Because, you know, it's been discussed before, but it never seems to have had any momentum.
Well, what you typically see is that when people want to expand a program, an agency, a department, and there is, frankly, just no cash to do it, that usually provides impetus to make some kind of significant permanent change. For instance, in the last downturn, we did make $3 billion worth of permanent structural changes, but we did all kinds of other things because we were dealing with an overall, over about 3 years, a $13 billion problem.
Lawsuit is still pending on the K-12 education situation. As you move forward to try to figure this out with the rest of your body and with the House, is anything off the table? Are taxes off the table or education cuts off the table?
I've always been one to say everything's on the table, but obviously I do not believe raising taxes, you know, in a time of recession, which I still think we're in, is really the best idea, because you're trying to stimulate the economy. You want to get jobs and job growth, and you want people to go back to work, because when people go back to work, that really would solve the lion's share, the vast majority of our problem with the budget. I'm also a big believer that you can have the discussion on virtually anything, and let's see what wins out.
You'll have Republican majorities in the legislature again, not a big surprise, with a Republican governor again. So does that mean sailing will be smoother in making these big decisions or not?
Governor Ducey administration, he's reached out and has been very accessible to the legislature. Both the Speaker of the House has told me that he's felt the same thing and has, like myself, been able to reach out and speak with the governor-elect and his transition team on a fairly regular basis. So the communication lines are significantly, they're just open. They're very open, and this governor-elect, Governor Ducey, is going to, I think, want to cooperate, and we're going to want to cooperate with him. And so it'll become a more collaborative process. So, yes, I do believe it will be easier to do some of these difficult things.
Your leadership team has been labeled by some, at least, as being more conservative than the previous Senate leadership. What kind of impact can that have? There are some who say that's going to lead to less compromise. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that as long as we continue with the policy that I have, which is an open-door policy, with the idea of I meet with the Democrat leadership every week, I think that provides an opportunity for us to reach some kind of accord on some of the things that we're doing. We may not always agree, but as long as we have the communication lines open, I think that we have a chance to have a pretty collegial atmosphere and an opportunity to get some things done that both sides would be happy with.
What priorities do you have that we haven't discussed for the next session? And, you know, there are some who gave the state a lot of flack because of SB 1062. I'm wondering if we can expect to see something similar to that bill coming up in the next session, and what are some other things we should be watching for?
Well, let me just take the 1062 question first. I have not heard of anything along those lines. I think people are and will continue to be concerned about the idea of religious liberties. And, you know, I mean, we even have a case out of Gilbert that's headed to the U.S. Supreme Court dealing with the restriction of a church to use signs. And so, I mean, but along with that, I know that different members have different priorities, whether it's within the commerce area, whether it's with taxing and finance, whether it's, you know, probate issues, whether it's Uber, Lyft versus traditional taxi, whether it's Tesla versus traditional auto retail dealers. I mean, you will see some of these, what I would call, and I hate to call them this, but turf battles, you know, where we have this, you want that kind of thing. But I think that everything is going to be surrounded by the budget. And if we can get to that early and make resolution and agreements with regard to the biggest aspects of that budget, which I think we can, I think we could work towards having an extremely short session.
Andy Biggs is president of the Arizona Senate. President Biggs, thanks for the time today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate being with you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In recent months, we've discussed domestic violence and its impact on families and the greater community. The broader consideration of the topic generated headlines, at least in part, because of NFL running back Ray Rice. Sexual assault on college campuses also received more national attention because of a controversial story in Rolling Stone magazine about the University of Virginia. ASU is one of dozens of colleges being investigated by the U.S. Department of Education for the way it handles complaints of sexual violence. Joining me for a few minutes to talk about that is Allie Bones, CEO of the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence. Allie, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What disturbs you the most, or what concerns you the most specifically about what's going on some college campuses?
Well, what concerns us is that responses are not consistent, it doesn't appear, and that things are not always handled in the most transparent way possible, and that victims are not always being believed in particular, that there doesn't appear to be a great understanding about the issue of sexual assault and sexual violence and how victims' experiences occur.
What is the problem with that? Why is there such a misunderstanding? This is not a new subject.
It is definitely not a new subject, and I think a lot of it has been kind of a culture of not wanting to scare the community about the issue of sexual assault. There has been a lot of silence about this issue, and what we're really trying to make sure now is that we bring this issue, you know, out of the silence and talk about it and make sure that universities have responses that help protect all victims.
What is the biggest, if there is one, biggest misperception of a sexual assault claim by someone? Is there that tendency to be in a disbelieving mode? I don't want to use this light reference, but almost the boy who cried wolf kind of thing. Is there too much of that, thinking that someone is doing it to get someone else and they're making it up?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we start from a point of skepticism all the time with these cases of sexual assault, which is interesting because in terms of other crimes, we don't question a person if they say that they have been, you know, had their car broken into or, you know, their house broken into. We tend to have sympathy for them and, you know, listen to and believe their stories. But for some reason, when it comes to sexual assault, we tend to quickly jump to, well, what was the victim doing? What did he or she do to provoke the situation? What were they wearing? Were they drinking? And we really question the victim and what he or she was doing, as opposed to, you know, having that same version of sympathy and, you know, trying to find out what happened in the situation.
Allie, coming back specifically to college campuses, there are a lot of people who go to college and they've left home for the first time. And this means alleged assaulters. It also means alleged victims. What about education? What do these students need to know before they step on a campus to make the right decisions? And this isn't to say that someone deserves it or anything else. It's not to say that someone is inclined to assault someone else. What do they need to know? What things should they be thinking about when they make certain decisions and when they become college students?
Yeah, I mean, we absolutely need to make sure that we have a focus on prevention and talking to students about situations and making sure that we're talking to people about what consent means and understanding situations where consent cannot be given. So if someone is under the influence of alcohol or drugs, then they are not in a position to give consent. And so making sure that people understand that, as well as having respect for and listening to other people's wishes and knowing that that is the first and foremost place that we should be starting in terms of sexual relations, that it isn't something that anyone is owed, that campus culture does not, you know, lend itself to everyone just being entitled to sex whenever they want it, however they want it, but that there are issues with that, and that we need to make sure that we are talking about sex in a healthy way.
And there's obviously a certain comfort level or lack of comfort level for a lot of folks, but how much of this has to start at a younger age, whether it's in the schools or at home?
Absolutely. We've got to be starting to have these conversations in high school, at home, even before that.
Allie, final question for you. Anything that gives you reason for optimism that people are getting more educated, that colleges are paying more attention to this?
I have a lot of optimism because we're talking about this. These conversations are happening. Task forces are being formed. There's policies being developed and training being implemented. And so I think and hope that things will change in the next couple of months and years.
Allie Bones is CEO of the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for joining us on Here and Now.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We've been hearing a lot about new federal racial profiling guidance released by the Department of Justice this past week. In many ways, the guidance does more to prevent federal law enforcement from profiling based on factors like race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, or religion. But there are exceptions, namely that the guidance does not apply to border enforcement. Joining me now is KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block. Jude, tell us how the guidance says the border is left out.
Well, there's a footnote. It says this guidance does not apply to interdiction activities in the vicinity of the border or to protective inspection or screening activities. So that has some civil rights and civil liberties advocates, such as those at the ACLU and some folks who grassroots groups on the border, saying this essentially exempts Customs and Border Protection, which includes Border Patrol.
Okay, so is this a surprise? The Bush administration also put out guidance to stop racial profiling back in 2003. It also had a loophole for the border and national security, right?
Right, and so there was a lot of speculation to what degree these loopholes would close when there were whisperings that this was coming up, that these racial profiling guidance was going to be updated. And it appears the rules are stricter now on national security issues, but not so much on the border. And there had been reporting that Attorney General Eric Holder wanted the guidance to extend to border enforcement, but that the Department of Homeland Security wouldn't sign off on that, with the idea that agents shouldn't be limited in that way.
So help me out here. If the guidance doesn't apply to border enforcement, does that mean current law actually allows border agents to use race or ethnicity or one of the other factors as a basis for making a stop?
I was surprised to learn the law isn't as cut and dry on this issue as you might expect. And it actually varies on where in the country you live. So there's a 40-year-old Supreme Court case on this issue. But more recently, in 2000, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had a different ruling that pertains to Western states.
Okay, so walk us through that. What did the Supreme Court say, and how long ago was that?
So that was back in 1975. The case involved a border agent who stopped a car near San Diego. And the only reason the agent gave for that making that stop was that the people inside looked Mexican and he wanted to question their immigration status. They challenged that stop on that basis. The Supreme Court decided that stop wasn't okay, that Mexican appearance couldn't be the only reason for stopping a car and questioning the people inside about their immigration status. But they did say there's a high chance that people of Mexican ancestry are here illegally, so it can be one of the factors border agents keep in mind.
Well, especially in Arizona, that seems tricky, though, since so many people here of Mexican heritage are legal U.S. citizens or residents.
And that's exactly the reason why the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2000, when they had to grapple with a similar case, decided, you know what, demographics have changed since that Supreme Court decision. And in areas where there's a lot of Latino residents who just live in that area, it's not fair to apply that standard anymore. So that's why here in Arizona, technically we're under that ruling, though it's confusing because you go over to New Mexico, you go over to Texas, and they're not under the Ninth Circuit. So it's a confusing patchwork, and a lot of people were hoping that this new guidance might clarify what's kind of a confusing area of the law right now.
Jude, we have about a minute left, and we keep hearing the words racial profiling attached to this long-running suit with the MCSO and Sheriff Joe Arpaio. How does this apply?
Well, it really doesn't, because this is for federal agents, so it doesn't impact this. But, some of this background is basically how we got into kind of the mess with the sheriff's office, in the sense that originally the sheriff's office was trained by ICE agents, and they were actually taught in that training the wrong rule. They were taught the Supreme Court rule that they could use Mexican appearance. And then later, so Judge Snow found, you should have been following the Ninth Circuit rule of saying, you can't use Latino appearance as a factor at all. And then, later on, the sheriff's office did not have federal authority to be doing immigration status when they lost their partnership with the federal government. So that was another factor in that case.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block helping to clear this up. Thanks, Jude.
Thank you, Steve.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, where teams of experts work together to care for each cancer patient as an individual. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/cancer.
Good morning. Along with Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ during the final day of our end of year 2014 drive, a great opportunity for you to call in and support public radio at 888-774-9150.
This is the last day of the end of year drive, and that means your time is running out to enter to win the Ireland and Scotland Adventure for Two. This is a very small group. About 25 folks will be going to Ireland and Scotland from May 30th to June 11th. You'll go to Dublin. You'll go to Edinburgh. You'll see all sorts of great stuff. You will eat all sorts of great stuff. If you are so inclined, you can drink all sorts of great stuff. It's a really exciting opportunity that you can enter by going to KJZZ.org when you donate at the KJZZ mobile app, or by calling 888-774-9150.
KJZZ, as you might have noticed, is making more of a commitment to local and regional coverage here on 91.5. A lot of you have told us in the past, I want to hear more about transportation. I want to hear more about government and politics, or I want to hear about arts and culture. I want to hear about what restaurants to go to, what's going on all around your backyard. And that's what we're trying to give to you more and more. 888-774-9150, the number to call to support this kind of coverage. Mark, coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll have a wrap-up of our We Are the Valley series.
A great series.
You've probably heard some of our conversations on Here and Now, some of the great features and pieces on the show. We found community in places we didn't necessarily expect to. If you were surprised by that, if you were enlightened by that, call now with a gift, 888-774-9150.
This is truly coverage that you simply will not find anywhere else. I mean, the kind of depth about our community and our neighborhoods, the voices from our neighborhoods and the folks that we live with and interact with on a daily basis, you just don't hear it anywhere else. You don't hear on KJZZ, you don't hear people yelling at each other, you don't hear people espousing unfounded opinions or anything. You hear from people who really know what they're talking about, people who have experience in various fields, and people who are passionate about this particular place. If you value that, and again, we think you do because you're listening right now, please make your gift right now, KJZZ.org. Get yourself entered to win the Ireland and Scotland Adventure for Two, 888-774-9150.
And when you become a sustaining member at KJZZ, you're helping this station, you're helping the public radio community grow and thrive into the future. Maybe become a $10 a month member, maybe $20 a month. Think about the money you spend in other places and how much you get back from this community resource. 7 days a week. The news does not take a break on the weekends here at KJZZ. You also have great entertainment programs. Remember, this drive ends tonight at 6. If you've done your part in 2014, we thank you. But if you haven't, why not? You have the opportunity to win the Ireland and Scotland Adventure for Two and endorse great community public radio. 888-774-9150.
A couple other things about becoming a sustaining member. One, you don't have to think about every month whether or not you're doing your part. Two, it provides your public radio station a reliable source of monthly support. Third, you're automatically entered to win every contest that we do here at KJZZ. And the list goes on and on. I'm just sort of giving a couple top three here. But for example, if you are already a sustaining member, you're automatically already entered to win the Ireland and Scotland Adventure. If you are not, no time like the present. KJZZ.org, 888-774-9150.
We're so appreciative that you listen to public radio. That's an important part. When listeners become members, that's what keeps public radio strong into the future and this community. Thanks to Sandra in Phoenix, who called 888-774-9150 to make her gift. She says KJZZ is informative, unbiased, and works to be all-encompassing. we certainly do work to be all-encompassing, to try to hear as many opinions. I think probably in public radio, one of the things we learn is that there isn't necessarily a right and wrong to things. People have different perspectives. We try to offer that to you. So get involved. Get a chance to win this Ireland and Scotland adventure for two at 888-774-9150.
Yeah, we also learn there's not just two sides to a story. There's a lot of sides to every story, and we try to bring you as many of them as possible. If you put a please put a dollar value on that kind of listening to news about your community, our community. Make your gift right now, KJZZ.org or 888-774-9150. And thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein. For the past 4 months, we've been presenting an occasional series on community called We Are the Valley. It's featured conversations with and reports on people who've come together, sometimes in unexpected ways, to change their lives and find support systems. One of the conversations we had when the series began was with Cindy Dash, co-owner of Changing Hands Bookstore, and one of the founders of Local First Arizona. Cindy joins me again as we wrap up We Are the Valley. Cindy, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
One thing we've learned in the course of this series is that place, by its strictest definition, may not be as vital going forward when it comes to building communities. As someone, again, who's involved in a place, and more than that, what do you think about a certain location, a certain meeting place, as far as it relates to community going forward?
I think, you know, places continue to be important, but they're shaping and they're shifting constantly. And I think design is becoming essential. Mm. So we see people want to gather in spaces, but for example, we're noticing in restaurants, they're putting in outlets all over the place so that people can gather with their technology or people can be by themselves in a public space. And then the question becomes, how do you afford to put in all those outlets and have people gather?
How much about building a community has to do with the common interests? How much has to do with the trust in trying to build a foundation? We hear about sustainability so much. That applies to communities as well.
You know, that's another great question. As I think about that, I think it's twofold. I think it depends on the people. I think there are people who are purposeful and they're at a place in their life where they need to be around people with common interests. They need to check in. You know, we need to know we're doing okay and we're on the right track. And then there's just other people that their purpose is sustainability. Their purpose is, what is my place here? And they're going to find different ways to gather. I think what's amazing is looking at places, and I brought this up last time, like parks, where you can see both happen in the same place. And I think that's ultimately going to be some of our best community spaces, where you have public and private spaces for people to gather. And again, you want it to be organic, but not everything organic works when it's man-made.
I'm going off the board a little bit on this one, but common interests, of course, vitally important in building a community. There are some, and I've even used this phrase, this idea that your family, whether you have eight kids or whether it's just yourself and cats or whatever it may be, that is sort of a mini community of its own. I wonder, when we think about our families as opposed to the broader community of common interests, when you think about things like that, is there anything that stands out that when we actually, because we always talk, joke about, we don't choose our families, but we do choose our friends and people we hang out with. How does that affect the concept of community?
You know, it's huge. I think, you know, the generation before my own, very much when they moved away from their family, it was blocks away. You know, that's what my dad's generation did. And then my generation moved as far as we could because we wanted to see the Great West or we wanted to live in big cities. But I think we either thought we would end up going back or our families would eventually come to us. And then because of economies crashing or because of jobs, people didn't move back. And then I'm noticing really that their people in those communities become their family. So, you know, it is essential, but I think everybody at some point wants someone to check in with who's outside of their family to see how they're doing.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Cindy Dash, one of the co-owners of Changing Hands Bookstore, also one of the founders of Local First Arizona. We're wrapping up our We Are the Valley community series. Cindy, how much of building a community has to include that comfort level of sharing new ideas and not really necessarily thinking that one way or the other is the right way?
You know, I think that's going to depend on the people. I think, for example, knitting groups are great examples of this. So you have some knitting groups where people want to get together and knit and perhaps laugh and just be around somebody doing the same activity. But then you'll have a different style of a knitting group that actually wants to learn and critique and grow. And sometimes you'll find the same person in both groups, but what I'm noticing is different people go to those different groups. So we seek out very much and we control the experiences we're going to have. People don't necessarily like surprises, and they don't necessarily, I think a lot depends on what your work day is like. If you work in a cubicle, you might seek out a community that's going to help you grow. But if you work in a business that might be really passionate and very involved in community itself, you might seek out a place where there's more quiet when you're around other people.
Mm-hmm. Changing hands is much more than this, but certainly when people think of a bookstore, they think of book discussion groups. And that's what made me think of this too, because there are some people who think, well, I'm going to read this book. I'm going to have this rich conversation with these other people. And in some cases, it's just, hey, it's neat that other people like to read books and I want to sort of sit and discuss with people. I mean, does that sort of fill in the same concept for you?
Exact same concept. I know there's, you know, and again, there's book discussion groups that are around perhaps, let's say, modern fiction, and it might be light and it's very much about the wine as it is the book. And then there's other ones that might be discussing political books and, you know, really heavy topics. And they come to, in a way, battle ideas. And then there's some people who really hate book discussion groups because they don't want people to challenge their ideas about that book. They want to be alone with their book and they want to like it the way they liked it.
Yeah. Do you think that except in rare cases, people have to be in search of a community or want a community to happen, or can this be sort of an organic thing that it's unexpected?
You know, again, I think it's twofold. I heard a great story this morning of a man who helped his neighborhood organize their Christmas lights, so it was all one. So, you know, he's definitely a leader out there. People became part of that community by agreeing to it, whether they were seeking it out or not. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, other forms of community I see a lot is parents of young children when they move. You know, their goal is finding their children's friends, but then ultimately they become this parent community group. And they didn't seek it out for themselves, but they sought it out for the needs of their family.
When we had you on before, we had talked about how different it is from, let's say, New York to Phoenix. The longer you're here, are you still noticing distinct differences?
Well, certainly in large part because of density, but, and I may have said this before, but I think we find the life that we want to live and we carve it out wherever we are. So, for example, for me, it's very important for me to walk to my community, to be able to walk every day. And it took me a while, but I figured out where to live in Phoenix in order to have that. So then my community is often who I pass when I'm walking or who I pass when I'm going to my coffee shop. Mm-hmm. There are ways to live in Phoenix, certainly, where you don't see the same people every day by choosing different coffee shops or not having coffee. Those similarities is I often laugh because the way I live my life, I could be living it in New York. The difference would be I'd be passing millions of people in an hour versus maybe 20.
Cindy, finally, in the broader sense of community, you talked about some people want to be alone with their book, for example, and you know, we all want to be alone sometimes. What are we missing as human beings if we don't continue to build communities, whether small or large?
For me, it's we lack the growth. We don't challenge ourselves. We don't get to ever ask, you know, is this idea correct? Is the way I'm thinking okay? And some people are always going to be okay with that. But I think for communities to evolve and to say, you know, can we leave this place better than we found it, we have to be able to check in with other people. And we are going to go to places that we're comfortable checking in and being challenged.
Cindy Dash is co-owner of Changing Hands Bookstore, also one of the founders of Local First Arizona. Thanks for talking community with us.
Thank you so much.
And Sarah Ventry was the producer of the series, and she's with me now. Now, Sarah, when you first started We Are the Valley, what were you hoping listeners would get out of it?
Well, the idea was really to look at what kinds of communities exist in Phoenix and kind of how they work. You know, Phoenix, we've talked a lot about how Phoenix has long been a place that people think of as community-less. You know, it's spread out. We don't always know our neighbors. And especially if you're new to town, it can be pretty tough, you know, to find a place where you feel like you fit in. But if you stay here long enough and dig in a little, you know, there's really lots of interesting, tight-knit communities here in town. So the hope was kind of that all of our listeners would share their stories with us, and then we could connect with one another and learn a little bit about the communities that, you know, we might not have known about.
Yeah, so after hearing all of these different stories and getting tapped into so many different community groups, did anything surprise you?
Yeah, you know, one thing that was really surprising was that a lot of people get connected online. So they're not online communities, right? They're real life, in-person communities. But in a lot of cases, people are finding each other online, even on places like meetup.com, which was kind of surprising to me.
Yeah.
I actually visited a community of women motorcyclists, and they do most of their organizing online. And the other thing that surprised me was there were a lot of activities or interests that I think of as more individualistic, but there are actually communities around a lot of these things. So the Women's Motorcycle Group is a really good example of that. I want to play for you a clip of Helen Skibitsky, the group's leader, getting everyone ready for a big group ride.
We will not leave anyone behind. We will not make a turn unless everybody's intact. So if we get separated, which not likely, and you can't see the group ahead of you or you don't know where you're going, do not panic. We will not make a turn without you. If that means pulling over to the side of the road till you catch up, that's what we'll do. Please don't panic and think you've got a haul ass to get home.
So you can hear, you know, this is something they all do together with one another, and that it's meant to be pretty empowering for everyone. And in this case, it works better to do it in a group than on your own.
Okay, so what else did you feel like you took away from working on these stories? I mean, a lot of these were in-depth stories. And as I said, you were the producer and had to really look over all these stories. You were editing all the scripts as well.
I was actually really impressed with how open people were and how willing they were to kind of come out and share their stories, even if they were very personal and even if they were, you know, things that are kind of private to a lot of people or to them and their own communities. And the other thing is that in a lot of cases, there were people who came from out of town or even out of state to be a part of a community here. So there were two examples of that that come to mind immediately, and I want to take a listen to them. The first is of a nudist community, and the second is a community of skateboarders.
I've met doctors, lawyers, even cruise ship captains and jumbo jet pilots. Nudist is more to being with people, you know, and sharing and talking, and I mean, it's not being nudist, just the freedom.
I'm from Illinois, but I come out here specifically because of all the great people. I mean, great parks and, you know, the weather, whatever, that's a bonus. But like all the people that I've met out here, that's what definitely keeps me coming back.
So that first clip was from Stina Sieg's piece on Shangri-La Ranch, and then the second was from Jimmy Jenkins' piece on a local skate park. And it was pretty amazing to really see that not only did Phoenix have, you know, an amazingly diverse number of communities, but that people actually sought them out here specifically. And then I think for me, the other thing was realizing that we in the Valley think of community maybe a little bit differently than people might in other places. So for us, it's not usually about geography or about living in a particular neighborhood. It's more about finding people that we can connect with. So for example, people will drive to their community. And it winds up being a little bit more intentional than accidental or coincidental. Mm-hmm. Like it's really hard to stumble on something, but if you look for it, you can definitely find people that you relate to and can be very close with.
So this is not an actual end of We Are the Valley. We're wrapping up the series for now. We'll continue to visit the communities on Here and Now in the show. But going forward, Sarah, what new angles do you want to explore that we should be thinking about?
You know, I'd really love to look at the ways communities intersect with one another. So you and I had talked about maybe trying to find communities of people with strong political ideologies and understanding the commonalities that they have with one another, even if they have very different ideologies, polarizing ideologies. You know, I'd also like to talk to more people who have kind of created their own communities, you know, people who have maybe noticed a void in their lives and then tried to build something new. So I definitely think that going forward, we've got some new stuff to explore.
Our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, she was the producer behind the long-running series, We Are the Valley. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
KJZZ is supported by Belmont Village Senior Living, providing assisted living and memory care in North Scottsdale. More information by calling 480-944-3600.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ at 1141. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Mark Brody. Still to come on the program, we'll hear from the director of a new documentary about former Phoenix Sun star Steve Nash. We'll also revisit an interesting conversation about Arizona's long and rich cultural history when it comes to country music. That'll be coming up in just a couple of minutes on Here and Now. In the meantime, you've got a couple of minutes to give us a call and become a sustaining member of this community resource. The number is 888-774-9150. That's the number Giles in Phoenix called.
Yeah, you want to make that gift right now because you get yourself entered to win the Ireland and Scotland Adventure for two. This membership drive ends tonight at 6 o'clock, started Monday morning. It's a short drive, so you don't have a ton of time to get yourself entered to win this thing. It's a very small group of people going to Ireland and Scotland from May 30th to June 11th of 2015. It includes airfare. You'll go to Dublin and Glasgow and Edinburgh. Lots of great stuff to do. And there are three ways that you can enter this. You can call 888-774-9150. $1.50. You can donate directly from the KJZZ mobile app, or you can go to kjzz.org.
When you got up this morning to listen to Morning Edition and listen to Here and Now, you probably weren't thinking to yourself, boy, this is a great day to win a trip to Ireland and Scotland.
Every day is a great day to win a trip to Ireland and Scotland.
Exactly, but it probably wasn't in the front of your mind.
True.
Because you were thinking, I want to get the best news and information. I want to hear what's going on in the world and my backyard. That's why you tune in to 91.5. And that's why we're coming to you during this very short end-of-year fund drive to ask for your tax-deductible gift to keep programs like Here and Now and Morning Edition and All Things Considered, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, all these programs thriving into 2015. So if you could make that $10 a month gift, become a sustaining member, a $20 a month gift, big or smaller, whatever works for you, we're asking you to do it now. This drive, as Mark mentioned, ends tonight at 6, 888-774-9150.
There is so much going on in our community, so much going on in Phoenix, in the Valley, and, you know, KJZZ tries to bring as much of that to you as possible to learn more about what's going on in our community. I mean, the We Are the Valley series, a perfect example of that. These groups of people doing things and you know, sort of supporting each other in ways that, frankly, I had never thought of. It's that kind of in-depth reporting, that kind of community resource that you're just not going to get anywhere else. So please put a dollar value on that listening, as Susan in Scottsdale did. She became a sustaining member, as did Barbara in Mesa. Just two of the people we want to say thank you to for becoming sustaining members and for keeping this service strong. KJZZ.org.
They've realized their individual importance. You are the most important source of funding for this radio station. We don't have any commercials. The government support is very tiny. Call right now. Support this community resource. It is talking about things going on in your backyard that you really care about. 888-774-9150 or kjzz.org.
Thanks also to Daniel in Sedona. He became a new member. Bill in Scottsdale, a sustaining member. Allison in Phoenix became a new sustaining member. Thank you so much. It is your turn now. Get yourself entered to win this Ireland and Scotland adventure. You want to at least give yourself a chance to win. You can enter at kjzz.org or by calling 888-774-9150. And thanks.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A new documentary called Nash is now available digitally in the U.S. It's about Steve Nash, arguably the most impactful player in the history of the Phoenix Suns. The film shows Nash playing, staying fit, carrying the Olympic torch in his native Canada. It also features people talking about Nash, including President Barack Obama.
People will look back at Steve as one of the greatest players of all time, a two-time MVP. My suspicion is he'll be in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, I think you're measured not just by your skills or your fame or your wealth, but by your character. And I think by that standard, he's going to do very well.
I talked with the director of Nash, Michael Hamilton.
If anybody knows Steve, they realize that he is a pretty private and humble guy. He doesn't like the spotlight. You know, he prefers to be, you know, behind the camera, but obviously that's not possible with, you know, his stature. It was something that I've always wanted to do, kind of a bigger feature film project on his journey, and approached him. And at first, you know, it was a little bit, took a little bit of convincing because of how he is. And I think at the end of the day, he just boiled down to trust and, you know, the relationship that we had before. And he kind of said, yeah, sure, why not?
Did you go into making the documentary with the idea of this is the way you wanted to tell the story, and it modified as you got to know more about him and his history, the struggles he had getting the college scholarship? They seem a little bit different from the usual superstar-level athlete.
Whenever you're making a film, especially documentaries, it doesn't matter what you think the story is going to be. It always changes. You know, we were struggling, like, what is the story? And obviously Steve's not your... He doesn't have that typical path that, you know, maybe some of the athletes and players, you know, growing up in the U.S. had. You know, he's had a great life, and it was always like, well, what's our, you know, what's the drama going to be in the film, you know? And maybe there isn't any, and maybe that's the story. That's, he's the anomaly almost. He kind of has done this on his own terms and in his own way and managed to navigate through a lot of challenges and obstacles that you see today in many athlete stories. And having said that, it doesn't mean that he hasn't had struggles and obstacles, because he obviously has. Like you mentioned, it was a tough road. not receiving a college scholarship. Basically, he only got one offer when he was in high school. And as soon as he got to the NBA, he was met with challenges and obstacles with his back injury and getting booed in Dallas. And every step of the way, you know, he's faced with some sort of adversity and obstacle. And I think that's why, you know, he's managed to carve out such a great career, is because he's been challenged throughout his career. You know, it hasn't been an easy kind of path.
Is he as special a person in terms of a professional athlete as it seems? Because, again, talking to you from Phoenix here, when the Suns recently had Steve Nash and Grant Hill, who's another future Hall of Fame NBA player, the issue was always, boy, these two guys just seem so intellectual and so worldly. How does that fit in an NBA locker room? Was Nash as unique as it seems?
Cool thing I learned about Steve is, like, what he says is, you know, what you get. Like, he is who he is, and, you know, he stands for what he believes in, and it's kind of refreshing to see that everything that he says is really what he kind of believes in and how he kind of lives his life.
Michael, you mentioned that he speaks his mind about things, and a few months ago he got some criticism because he told, I guess it was Grantland, he talked about how he had a salary, and even if he couldn't play, he felt like he had earned that salary, he'd signed a contract, he was going to try to come back certainly, but if he didn't, has the perception of Steve Nash changed as a guy who led this style of play that everyone loved? It was a winning organization, he was this great example, and then with the Lakers, he was going to play with Kobe and Dwight Howard, and his hairstyle changed and all this other stuff. Has the perception of him changed, and will it come back once he retires and people will realize what they're missing with him gone?
People that know Steve obviously, you know his work ethic and what he's about. And I think if you don't know Steve and you just see on the surface, like, oh, here's a guy, he's just sticking around for the money and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's too bad. And maybe those people will realize it when it's too late. But the majority of the people that understand the business of basketball and pro sports, and I had the opportunity to shoot some of his Grantland when he was training in Vancouver when he was trying to get healthy last year. And I got to tell you, man, unbelievable work ethic. What that guy went through or was going through just to get healthy was unbelievable. A normal person would have just packed it in a long time ago. He loves the game, and I think that's what he's going to be remembered for, and not the salary that he took in L.A., the last bit of his money. You know, I think that'll, you know, kind of go away. But what he will be remembered for is what he's done for the game of basketball, and he's done so many amazing things for the sport.
Michael Hamilton, the director of Nash, a new documentary about former Phoenix Suns star Steve Nash. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. Good morning, I'm Steve Goldstein. We're going to revisit a piece now. Arizona has a long and rich cultural history when it comes to music, especially country. And in Phoenix Magazine, managing editor Nikki D'Andrea explored the legacy of this music. I talked to her about just a few of the musicians that make Arizona's country history unique. Is there something about Jesse Coulter's music? You have Tanya Tucker in there as well. I think people associate her with Glen Campbell, but they also know maybe of her music on her own. Is there something that you can tell us about the sound of Jesse Coulter that would made her stand out as a country musician?
Certainly. Well, there are a couple of things. The first is that she was more of a pop country crossover artist. She was really one of the first female artists to make that crossover. She had a 1975 hit called I'm Not Lisa, which was a little more pop than country.
I'm not Lisa. My name is Julie.
Interestingly, Jesse Coulter is one of the first and one of the few women associated with the outlaw country music style, which of course her husband Waylon Jennings was associated with, and Willie Nelson. She recorded an album with Waylon and Willie Nelson and some of the other outlaws that became the first platinum selling country record, and it was called Wanted the Outlaws.
I'm looking for blue eyes. Has anyone seen him?
Is there a way to describe outlaw?
Don't Waylon Jennings was disillusioned with the symphonic kind of country-politan sound that was so popular in the 70s, uh-huh. with a lot of strings and ornamentation. And he wanted to take it back to more of a drum-driven, jangly, honky-tonk kind of sound. And that really became the outlaw country. The lyrics, also part of that, talking about drinking and, you know, rebel-rousing and that sort of thing. But really, stylistically, it was the sound. It was that harder, janglier, barn-burning kind of sound, as opposed to your grand old Opry kind of sound.
Lord, it's the same old tune, fiddle and guitar. Where do we take it from here? Rhinestone suits and new shiny cars. It's been the same way for years.
One person we haven't talked about yet, who is a real pioneer in her own sense, and way back, that most people, unless you're a music historian, wouldn't know about, is Billy Maxwell.
Standing alone in the doorway, through the twilight, straining my eyes, listening to hear the sharp hoofbeat, when my cowboy comes from the drive.
Definitely the earliest recording by any Arizona artist that we know of. There may be some Native American recordings at the Smithsonian that are earlier, but in terms of commercial records, this was our first commercial record. And she was born in the Arizona Territory in 1906 and grew up in a very, very, very small town. That's actually an exaggeration to say it's very, very, very small town. Population of 26 at the 2010 census. Nutrioso is the name of the town in the White Mountains. And she grew up in a family of ranchers, farmers, musical folk. But they weren't recording artists. They were just a family of people who played folk songs up on the mountain. And I actually found out about her through a music feature in Phoenix New Times, which was written by Sarah Ventre. And what we learned was a record scout had come through this little town of Nutrioso, and they auditioned for the record scout, and he offered them the chance to go to El Paso, Texas, to record three songs. And one thing Sarah and I discuss at length in the story is how harrowing this road trip must have been in 1929. With the vehicle that they had back then,
yes.
and the roads, and they drove from the White Mountains to El Paso to make these historical records that might have been lost if it were not for collectors like John P. Dixon and Al Perry down in Tucson trying to hunt them down, and then, of course, journalists like Sarah Ventre looking into the background story. If you listen to those recordings, you can hear the crackle and the hiss of history, and it almost sounds like you're listening through time, and that was a treat for me.
That was Phoenix Magazine Managing Editor Nikki D'Andrea talking about the legacy of country music here in Arizona. Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody.